Chapter 20 Continued.
"He wanted to stay here. Why?" asked Harry, more amazed still.
"I believe he had several reasons, though he confided none of them to Professor Dippet," said Dumbledore. "Firstly, and very importantly, Voldemort was, I believe, more attached to this school than he has ever been to a person. Hogwarts was where he had been happiest, the first and only place he had felt at home."
Harry felt slightly uncomfortable at these words, for this was exactly how he felt about Hogwarts too.
"Secondly, the castle is a stronghold of ancient magic. Undoubtedly Voldemort had penetrated many more of its secrets than most of the students who passed through the place, but he may have felt that there were still mysteries to unravel, stores of magic to tap. And thirdly, as a teacher, he would have had great power and influence over young witches and wizards. Perhaps he had gained the idea from Professor Slughorn, the teacher with whom he was on best terms, who had demonstrated how influential a role a teacher can play. I do not imagine for an instant that Voldemort envisaged spending the rest of his life at Hogwarts, but I do think that he saw it as a useful recruiting ground, and a place where he might begin to build himself an army."
"But he didn't get the job, sir."
"No, he did not. Professor Dippet told him that he was too young at 18, but invited him to reapply in a few years, if he still wished to teach."
"How did you feel about that, sir?" asked Harry hesitantly.
"Deeply uneasy," said Dumbledore.
"I had advised Armando against the appointment. I did not give the reasons I have given you, for Professor Dippet was very fond of Voldemort and convinced of his honesty, but I did not want Lord Voldemort back at this school, and especially not in a position of power."
"Which job did he want, sir? What subject did he want to teach?"
Somehow Harry knew the answer even before Dumbledore gave it. Defence against the Dark Arts. It was being taught at the time by an old professor by the name of Galatea Merrythought, who had been at Hogwarts for nearly 50 years. So Voldemort went off to Borgin and Birks, and all the staff who had admired him said what a waste it was, a brilliant young wizard like that working in a shop. However, Voldemort was no mere assistant. Polite and handsome and clever, he was soon given particular jobs of the type that only exist in a place like Borgin and Birks, which specialises, as you know, Harry, in objects with unusual and powerful properties. Voldemort was sent to persuade people to part with their treasures for sale by the partners, and he was, by all accounts, unusually gifted at doing this.
"Oh, bet he was," said Harry, unable to contain himself.
"Well, quite," said Dumbledore with a faint smile. "And now it is time to hear from Hokey the House Elf, who worked for a very old, very rich witch by the name of Hepzibah Smith." Dumbledore tapped a bottle with his wand, the cork flew out, and he tipped the swirling memory into the pensieve, saying as he did so, "After you, Harry." Harry got to his feet and bent once more over the rippling silver contents of the stone basin until his face touched them. He tumbled through dark nothingness and landed in a sitting room in front of an immensely fat old lady wearing an elaborate ginger wig and a brilliant pink set of robes that flowed all around her, giving her the look of a melting iced cake. She was looking into a small jewelled mirror and dabbing rouge onto her already scarlet cheeks with a large powder puff, while the tiniest and oldest house elf Harry had ever seen laced her fleshy feet into tight satin slippers.
"Hurry up, Hokey," said Hepzibah imperiously. "He said he'd come at 4, and it's only a couple of minutes too, and he's never been late yet."
She tucked away her powder puff as the house elf straightened up. The top of the elf's head
barely reached the seat of Hepzibah's chair, and her papery skin hung off her frame just like the crisp linen sheet she wore draped like a toga.
"How do I look?"
said Hepzibah, turning her head to admire the various angles of her face in the mirror.
"Lovely, madam,"
squeaked Hoki. Harry could only assume that it was down in Hoki's contract that she must lie through her teeth when asked this question, because Hepzibah Smith looked a long way from lovely, in his opinion. A tinkling doorbell rang, and both mistress and elf jumped.
"Quick, quick, he's here, Hoki!"
cried Hepzibah, and the elf scurried out of the room, which was so crammed with objects that it was difficult to see how anybody could navigate their way across it without knocking over at least a dozen things. There were cabinets full of little lacquered boxes, cases full of gold-embossed books, shelves of orbs and celestial globes, and many flourishing pot-plants in brass containers. In fact, the room looked like a cross between a magical antique shop and a conservatory. The house-elf returned within minutes, followed by a tall young man Harry had no difficulty whatsoever in recognizing as Voldemort. He was plainly dressed in a black suit. His hair was a little longer than it had been at school, and his cheeks were hollowed, but all of this suited him. He looked more handsome than ever. He picked his way through the cramped room with an air that showed he had visited many times before, and bowed low over Hepzibah's fat little hand, brushing it with his lips. "I brought you flowers," he said quietly, producing a bunch of roses from nowhere.
"You naughty boy! You shouldn't have!"
squealed old Hepzibah, though Harry noticed that she had an empty vase standing ready on the nearest little table.
"You do spoil this old lady, Tom. Sit down, sit down. Where's Hoki? Ah!"
The house-elf had come dashing back into the room, carrying a tray of little cakes, which she set at her mistress's elbow.
"Help yourself, Tom,"
said Hepzibah.
"I know how you love my cakes. Now, how are you? You look pale. They overwork you at that shop. I've said it 100 times.
Voldemort smiled mechanically, and Hepzibah simpered.
"Well, what's your excuse for visiting this time?"
she asked, batting her lashes. "Mr. Burke would like to make an improved offer for the goblin-made armour," said Voldemort. 500 galleons. He feels it is a more than fair—"
"Now, now, not so fast, or I'll think you're only here for my trinkets,"
pouted Hepzibah. "I am ordered here because of them," said Voldemort quietly. "I am only a poor assistant, madam, who must do as he is told. Mr. Burke wishes me to inquire—"
"Oh, Mr. Burke, fooey!"
said Hepzibah, waving a little hand.
"I've something to show you that I've never shown Mr. Burke. Can you keep a secret, Tom? Will you promise you won't tell Mr. Burke I've got it? He'd never let me rest if he knew I'd shown it to you, and I'm not selling, not to Burke, not to anyone. But you, Tom, you'll appreciate it for its history, not how many galleons you can get for it."
"I'd be glad to see anything Miss Hepzibah shows me," said Voldemort quietly, and Hepzibah gave another girlish giggle.
"I had Hoki bring it out for me. Hoki, where are you? I want to show Mr. Riddle our finest treasure. In fact, bring both while you're at it." "Here, madam,"
squeaked the house-elf, and Harry saw two leather boxes, one on top of the other, moving across the room as if of their own volition, though he knew the tiny elf was holding them over her head as she wended her way between tables, poofs, and footstools.
"Now,"
said Hepzibah happily, taking the boxes from the elf, laying them in her lap, and preparing to open the topmost one.
I think you'll like this, Tom. Oh, if my family knew I was showing you, they can't wait to get their hands on this.
She opened the lid. Harry edged forwards a little to get a better view, and saw what looked like a small golden cup with two finely wrought handles.
I wonder whether you know what it is, Tom.
Pick it up. Have a good look,
whispered Hepzibah, and Voldemort stretched out a long-fingered hand and lifted the cup by one handle out of its snug silken wrappings. Harry thought he saw a red gleam in his dark eyes. His greedy expression was curiously mirrored on Hepzibah's face, except that her tiny eyes were fixed upon Voldemort's handsome features.
"A badger," murmured Voldemort, examining the engraving upon the cup. "Then this was..."
"Helga Hufflepuff's, as you very well know, you clever boy," said Hepzibah, leaning forwards with a loud creaking of corsets and actually pinching his hollow cheek. "Didn't I tell you I was distantly descended? This has been handed down in the family for years and years. Lovely, isn't it? And all sorts of powers it's supposed to possess, too, but I haven't tested them thoroughly. I just keep it nice and safe in here."
She hooked the cup back off Voldemort's long forefinger and restored it gently to its box, too intent upon settling it carefully back into position to notice the shadow that crossed Voldemort's face as the cup was taken away.
"Now then," said Hepzibah happily, "where's Hokey? Oh, yes, there you are. Take that away now, Hokey."
The elf obediently took the boxed cup, and Hepzibah turned her attention to the much flatter box in her lap.
"I think you'll like this even more, Tom," she whispered. "Lean in a little, dear boy, so you can see. Of course, Burke knows I've got this one. I bought it from him. I dare say he'd love to get it back when I'm gone."
She slid back the fine filigree clasp and flipped open the box. There, upon the smooth crimson velvet, lay a heavy golden locket. Voldemort reached out his hand without invitation this time and held it up to the light, staring at it. "Slytherin's mark," he said quietly, as the light played upon an ornate serpentine S.
"That's right,"
said Hepzibah, delighted apparently at the sight of Voldemort gazing at her locket transfixed.
"I had to pay an arm and a leg for it, but I couldn't let it pass. Not a real treasure like that. I had to have it for my collection. Burke bought it, apparently, from a ragged-looking woman who seemed to have stolen it but had no idea of its true value."
There was no mistaking it this time. Voldemort's eyes flashed scarlet at her words, and Harry saw his knuckles whiten on the locket's chain.
"I dare say Burke paid her a pittance, but there you are. Pretty, isn't it? And again, all kinds of powers attributed to it, though I just keep it nice and safe."
She reached out to take the locket back. For a moment, Harry thought Voldemort was not going to let go of it. But then it had slid through his fingers and was back on its red velvet cushion.
"So, there you are, Tom, dear, and I hope you enjoyed that."
She looked him full in the face, and for the first time Harry saw her foolish smile falter.
"Are you all right, dear?"
"Oh, yes," said Voldemort quietly. "Yes, I'm very well."
"I thought that's a trick of the light, I suppose," said Hepzibah, looking unnerved,
and Harry guessed that she, too, had seen the momentary red gleam in Voldemort's eyes.
"Here, Hokey, take these away and lock them up again. The usual enchantments."
"Time to leave, Harry," said Dumbledore quietly, and as the little elf bobbed away bearing the boxes, Dumbledore grasped Harry once again above the elbow, and together they rose up through oblivion and back to Dumbledore's office.
"Hepzibah Smith died 2 days after that little scene," said Dumbledore, resuming his seat and indicating that Harry should do the same. "Hokey the house-elf was convicted by the Ministry of poisoning her mistress's evening cocoa by accident."
"No way!" said Harry angrily.
"I see we are of one mind," said Dumbledore.
"Certainly there are many similarities between this death and that of the Riddles. In both cases, somebody else took the blame, someone who had a clear memory of having caused the death.
Hokey confessed.
She remembered putting something in her mistress's cocoa that turned out not to be sugar, but a lethal and little-known poison," said Dumbledore. "It was concluded that she had not meant to do it, but being old and confused,
Voldemort modified her memory, just like he did with morphine."
"Yes, that is my conclusion too," said Dumbledore.
"And just as with morphine, the Ministry was predisposed to suspect Hokey."
"Because she was a house-elf," said Harry.
He had rarely felt more in sympathy with the society Hermione had set up, S.P.E.W.
"Precisely," said Dumbledore. "She was old, she admitted to having tampered with the drink, and nobody at the Ministry bothered to inquire further. As in the case of morphine, by the time I traced her and managed to extract this memory, her life was almost over. But her memory, of course, proves nothing except that Voldemort knew of the existence of the cup and the locket. By the time Hokey was convicted, Hepzibah's family had realized that two of her greatest treasures were missing. It took them a while to be sure of this, for she had many hiding places, having always guarded her collection most jealously. But before they were sure beyond doubt that the cup and the locket were both gone, the assistant who had worked at Borgin and Burke's, the young man who had visited Hepzibah so regularly and charmed her so well, had resigned his post and vanished. His superiors had no idea where he had gone. They were as surprised as anyone at his disappearance. And that was the last that was seen or heard of Tom Riddle for a very long time.
"Now," said Dumbledore, "if you don't mind, Harry, I want to pause once more to draw your attention to certain points of our story. Voldemort had committed another murder. Whether it was his first since he killed the Riddles, I do not know, but I think it was. This time, as you will have seen, he killed not for revenge, but for gain. He wanted the two fabulous trophies that poor, besotted old woman showed him. Just as he had once robbed the other children at his orphanage, just as he had stolen his Uncle Morphin's ring. So he ran off now with Hepzibah's cup and locket."
"But," said Harry, frowning, "it seems mad, risking everything, throwing away his job just for those—"
"Mad to you, perhaps, but not to Voldemort," said Dumbledore. "I hope you will understand in due course exactly what those objects meant to him, Harry. But you must admit that it is not difficult to imagine that he saw the locket, at least, as rightfully his."
"The locket may be," said Harry, "but why take the cup as well?"
"It had belonged to another of Hogwarts' founders," said Dumbledore. "I think he still felt a great pull towards the school, and that he could not resist an object so steeped in Hogwarts history. There were other reasons, I think. I hope to be able to demonstrate them to you in due course. And now for the very last recollection I have to show you, at least until you manage to retrieve Professor Slughorn's memory for us. 10 years separate Hokey's memory and this one. 10 years during which we can only guess at what Lord Voldemort was doing." Harry got to his feet once more as Dumbledore emptied the last memory into the pensieve.
"Whose memory is it?" he asked.
"Mine," said Dumbledore.
And Harry dived after Dumbledore through the shifting silver mass, landing in the very office he had just left.
There was Fawkes, slumbering happily on his perch, and there, behind the desk, was Dumbledore, who looked very similar to the Dumbledore standing beside Harry, though both hands were whole and undamaged, and his face was, perhaps, a little less lined. The one difference between the present-day office and this one was that it was snowing in the past. Bluish flecks were drifting past the window in the dark and building up on the outside ledge. The younger Dumbledore seemed to be waiting for something. And sure enough, moments after their arrival, there was a knock on the door, and he said, "Enter!" Harry let out a hastily stifled gasp. Voldemort had entered the room. His features were not those Harry had seen emerge from the great stone cauldron almost 2 years before. They were not as snake-like, the eyes were not yet scarlet, the face not yet mask-like, and yet he was no longer handsome Tom Riddle. It was as though his features had been burned and blurred. They were waxy and oddly distorted, and the whites of his eyes now had a permanently bloody look, though the pupils were not yet the slits that Harry knew they would become. He was wearing a long black cloak, and his face was as pale as the snow glistening on his shoulders. The Dumbledore behind the desk showed no sign of surprise. Evidently this visit had been made by appointment. "Good evening, Tom," said Dumbledore easily. "Won't you sit down?"
"Thank you," said Voldemort, and he took the seat to which Dumbledore had gestured,
the very seat, by the looks of it, that Harry had just vacated in the present.
"I heard that you had become headmaster," he said, and his voice was slightly higher and colder than it had been. "A worthy choice?"
"I'm glad you approve," said Dumbledore, smiling. "May I offer you a drink?"
"That would be welcome," said Voldemort. "I have come a long way."
Dumbledore stood and swept over to the cabinet where he now kept the pensieve, but which then was full of bottles. Having handed Voldemort a goblet of wine and poured one for himself, he returned to the seat behind his desk. "So, Tom, to what do I owe the pleasure?" Voldemort did not answer at once, but merely sipped his wine.
"They do not call me Tom any more," he said. "These days I am known as—"
"I know what you are known as," said Dumbledore, smiling pleasantly. "But to me, I'm afraid, you will always be Tom Riddle. It is one of the irritating things about old teachers, I'm afraid, that they never quite forget their charges' youthful beginnings." He raised his glass as though toasting Voldemort, whose face remained expressionless. Nevertheless, Harry felt the atmosphere in the room change subtly. Dumbledore's refusal to use Voldemort's chosen name was a refusal to allow Voldemort to dictate the terms of the meeting, and Harry could tell that Voldemort took it as such.
"I am surprised you have remained here so long," said Voldemort after a short pause. "I always wondered why a wizard such as yourself never wished to leave school."
"Well," said Dumbledore, still smiling, "to a wizard such as myself, there can be nothing more important than passing on ancient skills, helping hone young minds. If I remember correctly, you once saw the attraction of teaching, too."
"I see it still," said Voldemort. "I merely wondered why you, who is so often asked for advice by the Ministry, and who has twice, I think, been offered the post of Minister—"
"Three times at the last count, actually," said Dumbledore. "But the Ministry never attracted me as a career. Again, something we have in common, I think." Voldemort inclined his head, unsmiling, and took another sip of wine. Dumbledore did not break the silence that stretched between them now, but waited, with a look of pleasant expectancy, for Voldemort to talk first.
"I have returned," he said after a little while. "Later, perhaps, than Professor Dippet expected, but I have returned, nevertheless, to request again what he once told me I was too young to have. I have come to you to ask that you permit me to return to this castle to teach. I think you must know that I have seen and done much since I left this place. I could show and tell your students things they can gain from no other wizard."
Dumbledore considered Voldemort over the top of his own goblet for a while before speaking.
"Yes, I certainly do know that you have seen and done much since leaving us," he said quietly. "Rumours of your doings have reached your old school, Tom. I should be sorry to believe half of them."
Voldemort's expression remained impassive as he said,
"Greatness inspires envy. Envy engenders spite. Spite spawns lies. You must know this, Dumbledore."
"You call it greatness, what you have been doing, do you?"
asked Dumbledore delicately.
"Certainly,"
said Voldemort, and his eyes seemed to burn red.
"I have experimented. I have pushed the boundaries of magic further, perhaps, than they have ever been pushed."
"Of some kinds of magic," Dumbledore corrected him quietly. "Of some.
Of others, you remain, forgive me, woefully ignorant."
For the first time, Voldemort smiled. It was a taut leer, an evil thing, more threatening than a look of rage.
"The old argument," he said softly. "But nothing I have seen in the world has supported your famous pronouncements that love is more powerful than my kind of magic, Dumbledore."
"Perhaps you have been looking in the wrong places," suggested Dumbledore. "Well, then, what better place to start my fresh researches than here at Hogwarts?" said Voldemort. "Will you let me return? Will you let me share my knowledge with your students? I place myself and my talents at your disposal. I am yours to command."
Dumbledore raised his eyebrows. "And what will become of those whom you command? What will happen to those who call themselves, or so rumour has it, the Death Eaters?" Harry could tell that Voldemort had not expected Dumbledore to know this name. He saw Voldemort's eyes flash red again and the slit-like nostrils flare.
"My friends," he said after a moment's pause, "will carry on without me, I am sure."
"I am glad to hear that you consider them friends," said Dumbledore. "I was under the impression that they are more in the order of servants."
"You are mistaken," said Voldemort.
"Then if I were to go to the Hog's Head tonight, I would not find a group of them, Knott, Rosier, Mulciber, Dolohoff, awaiting your return? Devoted friends indeed, to travel this far with you on a snowy night, merely to wish you luck as you attempted to secure a teaching post?"
There could be no doubt that Dumbledore's detailed knowledge of those with whom he was travelling was even less welcome to Voldemort. However, he rallied almost at once.
"You are omniscient as ever, Dumbledore?"
"Oh, no, merely friendly with the local barman," said Dumbledore lightly. "Now, Tom."
Dumbledore set down his empty glass and drew himself up in his seat, the tips of his fingers together in a very characteristic gesture.
"Let us speak openly. Why have you come here tonight, surrounded by henchmen, to request a job we both know you do not want?"
Voldemort looked coldly surprised.
"A job I do not want? On the contrary, Dumbledore, I want it very much."
"Oh, you want to come back to Hogwarts, but you do not want to teach any more than you wanted to when you were 18. What is it you're after, Tom? Why not try an open request for once?"
Voldemort sneered.
"If you do not want to give me a job..."
"Of course I don't," said Dumbledore. "'And I don't think for a moment you expected me to. "'Nevertheless, you came here. You asked. "'You must have had a purpose.' "'Voldemort stood up. "'He looked less like Tom Riddle than ever, "'his features thick with rage.
"'This is your final word?'
"'It is,' said Dumbledore, also standing.
"'Then we have nothing more to say to each other.'
"'No, nothing.' said Dumbledore, and a great sadness filled his face. The time is long gone when I could frighten you with a burning wardrobe and force you to make repayment for your crimes. But I wish I could, Tom. I wish I could. For a second, Harry was on the verge of shouting a pointless warning. He was sure that Voldemort's hand had twitched towards his pocket and his wand. But then the moment had passed. Voldemort had turned away, the door was closing, and he was gone. Harry felt Dumbledore's hand close over his arm again, and moments later they were standing together on almost the same spot. But there was no snow building on the window ledge, and Dumbledore's hand was blackened and dead-looking once more. "Why?" said Harry at once, looking up into Dumbledore's face. "'Why did he come back? Did you ever find out?' "'I have ideas,' said Dumbledore, "'but no more than that.' "'What ideas, sir?' "'I shall tell you, Harry, when you have retrieved that memory from Professor Slughorn,' said Dumbledore. "'When you have that last piece of the jigsaw, everything will, I hope, be clear to both of us.' Harry was still burning with curiosity, and even though Dumbledore had walked to the door and was holding it open for him, he did not move at once. "'Was he after the defence against the Dark Arts job again, sir? He didn't say.' "'Oh, he definitely wanted the defence against the Dark Arts job,' said Dumbledore. "'The aftermath of our little meeting proved that. You see, we have never been able to keep a defence against the Dark Arts teacher for longer than a year since I refused the post to Lord Voldemort. Chapter 21 The Unknowable Room Harry racked his brains over the next week as to how he was to persuade Slughorn to hand over the true memory. But nothing in the nature of a brainwave occurred, and he was reduced to doing what he did increasingly these days when at a loss, poring over his potions book, hoping that the prince would have scribbled something useful in a margin, as he had done so many times before. "'You won't find anything in there,' said Hermione firmly, late on Sunday evening. "'Don't start, Hermione,' said Harry. "'If it hadn't been for the prince, Ron wouldn't be sitting here now. "'He would if you'd just listened to Snape in our first year,' said Hermione dismissively. Harry ignored her. He had just found an incantation, Sectum Sempra, scrawled in a margin above the intriguing words, For Enemies, and was itching to try it out, but thought it best not to in front of Hermione. Instead, he surreptitiously folded down the corner of the page. They were sitting beside the fire in the common room. The only other people still up were fellow sixth years. There had been a certain amount of excitement earlier, when they had come back from dinner to find a new sign on the notice board that announced the date for their apparition test. Those who would be 17 on or before the first test date, the 21st of April, had the option of signing up for additional practice sessions, which would take place, heavily supervised, in Hogsmeade. Ron had panicked on reading this notice. He had still not managed to apparate, and feared he would not be ready for the test. Hermione, who had now achieved apparition twice, was a little more confident. But Harry, who would not be 17 for another 4 months, could not take the test whether ready or not. "'At least you can apparate, though,' said Ron tensely. "'You'll have no trouble come July.' "'I've only done it once,' Harry reminded him.
He had finally managed to disappear and rematerialize inside his hoop during their previous lesson. Having wasted a lot of time worrying aloud about apparition, Ron was now struggling to finish a viciously difficult essay for Snape that Harry and Hermione had already completed. Harry fully expected to receive low marks on his because he had disagreed with Snape on the best way to tackle Dementors, but he did not care. Slughorn's memory was the most important thing to him now.
"I'm telling you, the stupid prince isn't going to be able to help you with this, Harry," said Hermione more loudly. "There's only one way to force someone to do what you want, and that's the Imperius Curse, which is illegal."
"Yeah, I know that, thanks," said Harry, not looking up from the book. "That's why I'm looking for something different. Dumbledore says Veritaserum won't do it, but there might be something else, a potion or a spell."
"You're going about it the wrong way," said Hermione. "Only you can get the memory, Dumbledore says. That must mean you can persuade Slughorn where other people can't. It's not a question of slipping him a potion. Anyone could do that."
"How do you spell belligerent?" said Ron, shaking his quill very hard while staring at his parchment. "It can't be B-U-M."
"No, it isn't," said Hermione, pulling Ron's essay towards her.
"And augury doesn't begin O-R-G either. What kind of quill are you using?" "It's one of Fred and George's spell-checking ones, but I think the charm must be wearing off."
"Yes, it must," said Hermione, pointing at the title of his essay, "because we were asked how we'd deal with Dementors, not Doug Boggs, and I don't remember you changing your name to Runil Waslib either."
"Oh, no," said Ron, staring horror-struck at the parchment. "Don't say I'll have to write the whole thing out again."
"It's okay, we can fix it," said Hermione,
pulling the essay towards her and taking out her wand. "I love you, Hermione," said Ron, sinking back in his chair, rubbing his eyes wearily. Hermione turned faintly pink, but merely said,
"Don't let Lavender hear you saying that."
"I won't," said Ron into his hands.
"Or maybe I will. Then she'll ditch me."
"Why don't you ditch her if you want to finish it?" asked Harry. "You have never chucked anyone, have you?" said Ron. "You and Cho just sort of fell apart."
"Yeah," said Harry.
"Wish that would happen with me and Lavender," said Ron gloomily, watching Hermione silently tapping each of his misspelled words with the end of her wand so that they corrected themselves on the page. "But the more I hint I want to finish it, the tighter she holds on. It's like going out with a giant squid."
"There," said Hermione some 20 minutes later, handing back Ron's essay.
"Thanks a million," said Ron.
"Can I borrow your quill for the conclusion?"
Harry, who had found nothing useful in the Half-Blood Prince's notes so far, looked around. The three of them were now the only ones left in the common room, Seamus having just gone up to bed, cursing Snape and his essay. The only sounds were the crackling of the fire and Ron scratching out one last paragraph on Dementors using Hermione's quill. Harry had just closed the Half-Blood Prince's book, yawning, when crack! Hermione let out a little shriek. Ron spilled ink all over his essay, and Harry said, "Creature!" The house elf bowed low and addressed his own gnarled toes.
"Master said he wanted regular reports on what the Malfoy boy is doing, so Creature has come to give crack!"
Dobby appeared alongside Creature, his tea-cosy hat askew.
"Dobby has been helping too, Harry Potter,"
he squeaked, casting Creature a resentful look.
"And Creature ought to tell Dobby when he is coming to see Harry Potter, so they can make their reports together."
"What is this?"
asked Hermione, still looking shocked by these sudden appearances.
"What's going on, Harry?"
Harry hesitated before answering, because he had not told Hermione about setting Creature and Dobby to tail Malfoy. House elves were always such a touchy subject with her.
"Well,
"'They've been following Malfoy for me,' he said.
"'Night and day,'
croaked Creature.
"'Dobby has not slept for a week, Harry Potter,'
said Dobby proudly, swaying where he stood. Hermione looked indignant.
"'You haven't slept, Dobby. But surely, Harry, you didn't tell him not to—'
"'No, of course I didn't,' said Harry quickly. "'Dobby, you can sleep, all right? But has either of you found out anything?' he hastened to ask, before Hermione could intervene again.
"'Master Malfoy moves with a nobility that befits his pure blood,'
croaked Creature at once.
"'His features recall the fine bones of my mistress, and his manners are those of—' "'Draco Malfoy is a bad boy!'
squeaked Dobby angrily.
"'A bad boy? Who—who—'
He shuddered from the tassel of his tea-cosy to the toes of his socks, and then ran at the fire as though about to dive into it. Harry, to whom this was not entirely unexpected, caught him around the middle and held him fast. For a few seconds Dobby struggled, then went limp.
"'Thank you, Harry Potter,' he panted. "'Dobby still finds it difficult to speak ill of his old masters.'
Harry released him. Dobby straightened his tea-cosy and said defiantly to Creature,
"'But Creature should know that Draco Malfoy is not a good master to a house-elf!'
"'Yeah, we don't need to hear about you being in love with Malfoy,' Harry told Creature. "'Let's fast-forward to where he's actually been going.' Creature bowed again, looking furious, and then said,
"'Master Malfoy eats in the Great Hall.' He sleeps in a dormitory in the dungeons. He attends his classes in a variety of—
"'Dobby, you tell me,' said Harry, cutting across Creature. "'Has he been going anywhere he shouldn't have?'
"'Harry Potter, sir!'
squeaked Dobby, his great orb-like eyes shining in the firelight.
"'The Malfoy boy is breaking no rules that Dobby can discover, but he is still keen to avoid detection.' "'He has been making regular visits to the seventh floor "'with a variety of other students who keep watch for him "'while he enters
the Room of Requirement,' said Harry, "'smacking himself hard on the forehead with advanced potion-making. "'Hermione and Ron stared at him.
"'That's where he's been sneaking off to. "'That's where he's doing whatever he's doing.' "'And I bet that's why he's been disappearing off the map. "'Come to think of it, I've never seen the Room of Requirement on there.'
"'Maybe the Marauders never knew the room was there,' said Ron.
"'I think it'll be part of the magic of the room,' said Hermione. "'If you need it to be unplottable, it will be.'
"'Dobby, have you managed to get in to have a look at what Malfoy's doing?' said Harry eagerly.
"'No, Harry Potter, that is impossible,'
said Dobby.
"'No, it's not,' said Harry at once. "'Malfoy got into our headquarters there last year, "'so I'll be able to get in and spy on him no problem.'
"'But I don't think you will, Harry,' said Hermione slowly. "'Malfoy already knew exactly how we were using the room, didn't he? "'Because that stupid Marietta had blabbed. "'He needed the room to become the headquarters of the DA, so it did.' But you don't know what the room becomes when Malfoy goes in there, so you don't know what to ask it to transform into.
There'll be a way around that, said Harry dismissively.
You've done brilliantly, Dobby.
Creature's done well too, said Hermione kindly. But far from looking grateful, Creature averted his huge bloodshot eyes and croaked at the ceiling.
The mudblood is speaking to Creature. "'Creature will pretend he cannot hear.'
"'Get out of it!' Harry snapped at him, and Creature made one last deep bow and disapparated. "'You'd better go and get some sleep too, Dobby.'
"'Thank you, Harry Potter, sir,'
squeaked Dobby happily, and he too vanished.
"'How good's this?' said Harry enthusiastically, turning to Ron and Hermione the moment the room was elf-free again. "'We know where Malfoy's going. We've got him cornered now.'
"'Yeah, it's great,' said Ron glumly, who was attempting to mop up the sodden mass of ink that had recently been an almost completed essay. Hermione pulled it towards her and began siphoning the ink off with her wand.
But what's all this about him going up there with a variety of students? Said Hermione. How many people are in on it? You wouldn't think he'd trust lots of them to know what he's doing.
Yeah, that is weird, said Harry, frowning.
I heard him telling Crabbe it wasn't Crabbe's business what he was doing. So what's he telling all these...
Harry's voice tailed away. He was staring at the fire.
God, I've been stupid, he said quietly. It's obvious, isn't it? There was a great vat of it down in the dungeon. He could have nicked some any time during that lesson.
Nicked what? Said Ron.
Polyjuice potion. He stole some of the polyjuice potion Slughorn showed us in our first potions lesson. There aren't a whole variety of students standing guard for Malfoy. It's just Crabbe and Goyle as usual. Yeah, it all fits, said Harry, jumping up and starting to pace in front of the fire. They're stupid enough to do what they're told, even if he won't tell them what he's up to. But he doesn't want them to be seen lurking around outside the Room of Requirement, so he's got them taking polyjuice to make them look like other people. Those two girls I saw him with when he missed Quidditch. Ha! Crabbe and Goyle!
Do you mean to say, said Hermione in a hushed voice, that that little girl whose scales I repaired...
Yeah, of course! Said Harry loudly, staring at her. Of course! Malfoy must have been inside the room at the time, so she... What am I talking about? He dropped the scales to tell Malfoy not to come out, because there was someone there. And there was that girl who dropped the toad spawn, too. We've been walking past him all the time and not realizing it.
He's got Crabbe and Goyle transforming into girls,
guffawed Ron.
Blimey! No wonder they don't look too happy these days. I'm surprised they don't tell him to stuff it.
Well, they wouldn't, would they, if he's shown them his dark mark, said Harry.
The dark mark we don't know exists, said Hermione sceptically, rolling up Ron's dried essay before it could come to any more harm and handing it to him.
We'll see, said Harry confidently.
Yes, we will, Hermione said, getting to her feet and stretching. But, Harry, before you get all excited, I still don't think you'll be able to get into the Room of Requirement without knowing what's there first. And I don't think you should forget...
She heaved her bag onto her shoulder and gave him a very serious look.
..that what you're supposed to be concentrating on is getting that memory from Slughorn. Good night.
Harry watched her go, feeling slightly disgruntled. Once the door to the girls' dormitories had closed behind her, he rounded on Ron.
What do you think?
Wish I could disapparate like a house elf, said Ron, staring at the spot where Dobby had vanished. I'd have that apparition test in the bag. Harry did not sleep well that night. He lay awake for what felt like hours, wondering how Malfoy was using the Room of Requirement, and what he, Harry, would see when he went in there the following day. For whatever Hermione said, Harry was sure that if Malfoy had been able to see the headquarters of the DA, he would be able to see Malfoy's... What could it be? A meeting place? A hideout? A storeroom? A workshop? Harry's mind worked feverishly, and his dreams, when he finally fell asleep, were broken and disturbed by images of Malfoy, who turned into Slughorn, who turned into Snape. Harry was in a state of great anticipation over breakfast the following morning. He had a free period before Defence Against the Dark Arts, and was determined to spend it trying to get into the Room of Requirement. Hermione was rather ostentatiously showing no interest in his whispered plans for forcing entry into the room, which irritated Harry because he thought she might be a lot of help if she wanted to.
Look, he said quietly, leaning forwards and putting a hand on the Daily Prophet, which she had just removed from a post owl, to stop her opening it and vanishing behind it. I haven't forgotten about Slughorn, but I haven't got a clue how to get that memory off him, and until I get a brainwave,
Why shouldn't I find out what Malfoy's doing?
I've already told you, you need to persuade Slughorn, said Hermione. It's not a question of tricking him or bewitching him, or Dumbledore could have done it in a second. Instead of messing around outside the Room of Requirement, she jerked the prophet out from under Harry's hand and unfolded it to look at the front page. You should go and find Slughorn and start appealing to his better nature.
Anyone we know? Asked Ron as Hermione scanned the headlines.
Yes, said Hermione, causing both Harry and Ron to gag on their breakfast. But it's all right. He's not dead. It's Mundungus. He's been arrested and sent to Azkaban. Something to do with impersonating an Inferius during an attempted burglary. And someone called Octavius Pepper has vanished. Oh, and how horrible. A 9-year-old boy has been arrested for trying to kill his grandparents. They think he was under the Imperius curse.
They finished their breakfast in silence. Hermione set off immediately for ancient runes, Ron for the common room, where he still had to finish his conclusion on Snape's Dementor essay, and Harry for the corridor on the 7th floor and the stretch of wall opposite the tapestry of Barnabas the Barmy teaching trolls to do ballet. Harry slipped on his invisibility cloak once he had found an empty passage, but he need not have bothered. When he reached his destination, he found it deserted. Harry was not sure whether his chances of getting inside the room were better with Malfoy inside it or out, but at least his first attempt was not going to be complicated by the presence of Crabbe or Goyle pretending to be an 11-year-old girl. He closed his eyes as he approached the place where the Room of Requirements door was concealed. He knew what he had to do. He had become most accomplished at it last year. Concentrating with all his might, he thought, "I need to see what Malfoy's doing in here. I need to see what Malfoy's doing in here. I need to see what Malfoy's doing in here." 3 times he walked past the door. Then, his heart pounding with excitement, he opened his eyes and faced it. But he was still looking at a stretch of mundanely blank wall. He moved forwards and gave it an experimental push. The stone remained solid and unyielding.
"Okay," said Harry aloud. "Okay, I thought the wrong thing."
He pondered for a moment, then set off again, eyes closed, concentrating as hard as he could. "I need to see the place where Malfoy keeps coming secretly. I need to see the place where Malfoy keeps coming secretly." After 3 walks past, he opened his eyes expectantly. There was no door.
"Oh, come off it," he told the wall irritably. "That was a clear instruction." "Fine."
He thought hard for several minutes before striding off once more.
"I need you to become the place you become for Draco Malfoy."
He did not immediately open his eyes when he had finished his patrolling. He was listening hard, as though he might hear the door pop into existence. He heard nothing, however, except the distant twittering of birds outside. He opened his eyes. There was still no door. Harry swore. Someone screamed. He looked around to see a gaggle of first-years running back round the corner, apparently under the impression that they had just encountered a particularly foul-mouthed ghost. Harry tried every variation of "I need to see what Draco Malfoy is doing inside you" that he could think of for a whole hour, at the end of which he was forced to concede that Hermione might have had a point. The room simply did not want to open for him. Frustrated and annoyed, he set off for defence against the dark arts, pulling off his invisibility cloak and stuffing it into his bag as he went.
"Late again, Potter,"
said Snape coldly, as Harry hurried into the candle-lit classroom.
10 points from Gryffindor."
Harry scowled at Snape as he flung himself into the seat beside Ron. Half the class was still on its feet, taking out books and organizing its things. He could not be much later than any of them.
"Before we start, I want your Dementor essays," said Snape, waving his wand carelessly, so that 25 scrolls of parchment soared into the air and landed in a neat pile on his desk.
"And I hope for your sakes they are better than the tripe I had to endure on resisting the Imperious curse. Now, if you will all open your books at page—what is it, Mr. Finnegan?"
"Sir," said Seamus, "I've been wondering, how do you tell the difference between an Inferius and a ghost? Because there was something in the prophet about an Inferius—"
"No, there wasn't," said Snape in a bored voice.
"But, sir, I heard people talking."
"If you had actually read the article in question, Mr. Finnegan, you would have known that the so-called Inferius was nothing but a smelly sneak thief by the name of Mundungus Fletcher."
"I thought Snape and Mundungus were on the same side," muttered Harry to Ron and Hermione. "Shouldn't he be upset Mundungus has been arrested?"
"But Potter seems to have a lot to say on the subject," said Snape, pointing suddenly at the back of the room, his black eyes fixed on Harry. "Let us ask Potter how he would tell the difference between an Inferius and a ghost."
The whole class looked round at Harry, who hastily tried to recall what Dumbledore had told him the night that they had gone to visit Slughorn.
Well, ghosts are transparent," he said.
"Oh, very good," interrupted Snape, his lip curling.
"Yes, it is easy to see that nearly 6 years of magical education have not been wasted on you, Potter. Ghosts are transparent."
Pansy Parkinson let out a high-pitched giggle. Several other people were smirking. Harry took a deep breath and continued calmly, though his insides were boiling.
"Yeah, ghosts are transparent, but inferi are dead bodies, aren't they? So they'd be solid."
"A 5-year-old could have told us as much," sneered Snape. "The Inferius is a corpse that has been reanimated by a dark wizard's spells. It is not alive. It is merely used like a puppet to do the wizard's bidding. A ghost, as I trust that you are all aware by now, is the imprint of a departed soul left upon the earth. And, of course, as Potter so wisely tells us, transparent."
"Well, what Harry said is the most useful if we're trying to tell them apart," said Ron. "When we come face to face with one down a dark alley, we're going to be having a shifty to see if it's solid, aren't we? We're not going to be asking, 'Excuse me, are you the imprint of a departed soul?'" There was a ripple of laughter, instantly quelled by the look Snape gave the class.
"Another 10 points from Gryffindor," said Snape. "I would expect nothing more sophisticated from you, Ronald Weasley. The boy is so solid he cannot apparate 1/2 inch across a room."
"No," whispered Hermione, grabbing Harry's arm as he opened his mouth furiously. "There's no point. You'll just end up in detention again. Leave it."
"Now, open your books at page 213, said Snape, smirking a little, "and read the first 2 paragraphs on the Cruciatus curse."
Ron was very subdued all through the class. When the bell sounded at the end of the lesson, Lavender caught up with Ron and Harry, Hermione mysteriously melted out of sight as she approached, and abused Snape hotly for his jibe about Ron's apparition. But this seemed merely to irritate Ron, and he shook her off by making a detour into the boys' bathroom with Harry.
"Snape's right, though, isn't he?" said Ron, after staring into a cracked mirror for a minute or two. "I don't know whether it's worth me taking the test. I just can't get the hang of apparition."
"You might as well do the extra practice sessions in Hogsmeade and see where they get you," said Harry reasonably. "It'll be more interesting than trying to get into a stupid hoop, anyway. Then if you're still not, you know, as good as you'd like to be, you can postpone the test. Do it with me over the Myrtle, this is the boys' bathroom." the ghost of a girl had risen out of the toilet in a cubicle behind them and was now floating in mid-air, staring at them through thick white round glasses.
"Oh," she said glumly, "it's you two."
"Who were you expecting?" said Ron, looking at her in the mirror.
"Nobody," said Myrtle, picking moodily at a spot on her chin. "He said he'd come back and see me, but then you said you'd pop in and visit me too."
She gave Harry a reproachful look.
"And I haven't seen you for months and months. I've learned not to expect too much from boys."
"I thought you lived in that girl's bathroom," said Harry, who had been careful to give the place a wide berth for some years now.
"I do," she said with a sulky little shrug. "But that doesn't mean I can't visit other places. I came and saw you in your bath once, remember?"
"Vividly," said Harry.
"But I thought he liked me," she said plaintively. "Maybe if you two left, he'd come back again. We had lots in common. I'm sure he felt it."
And she looked hopefully towards the door.
"When you say you had lots in common," said Ron, sounding rather amused now, "do you mean he lives in an S-bend too?"
"No!"
said Myrtle defiantly, her voice echoing loudly around the old tiled bathroom.
"I mean he's sensitive. People bully him too, and he feels lonely and hasn't got anybody to talk to, and he's not afraid to show his feelings and cry."
"There's been a boy in here crying," said Harry curiously. "A young boy?"
"Never you mind," said Myrtle, her small, leaky eyes fixed on Ron, who was now definitely grinning. "I promised I wouldn't tell anyone, and I'll take his secret to the..."
"Not the grave, surely," said Ron with a snort. "The sewers, maybe."
Myrtle gave a howl of rage and dived back into the toilet, causing water to slop over the sides and onto the floor. Goading Myrtle seemed to have put fresh heart into Ron. "You're right," he said, swinging his school bag back over his shoulder. "I'll do the practice sessions in Hogsmeade before I decide about taking the test." And so the following weekend, Ron joined Hermione and the rest of the 6th years who would turn 17 in time to take the test in a fortnight. Harry felt rather jealous watching them all get ready to go into the village. He missed making trips there, and it was a particularly fine spring day, one of the first clear skies they had seen in a long time. However, he had decided to use the time to attempt another assault on the Room of Requirement. "You'd do better," said Hermione, when he confided this plan to Ron and her in the entrance hall, "to go straight to Slughorn's office and try and get that memory from him."
"I've been trying," said Harry crossly,
which was perfectly true. He had lagged behind after every potions lesson that week in an attempt to corner Slughorn. But the potions master always left the dungeon so fast that Harry had not been able to catch him. Twice Harry had gone to his office and knocked, but received no reply, though on the second occasion he was sure he had heard the quickly stifled sounds of an old gramophone. "He doesn't want to talk to me, Hermione. He can tell I've been trying to get him on his own again, and he's not going to let it happen. When you've just got to keep at it, haven't you?" The short queue of people waiting to file past Filch, who was doing his usual prodding act with a secrecy sensor, moved forwards a few steps, and Harry did not answer in case he was overheard by the caretaker. He wished Ron and Hermione luck, then turned and climbed the marble staircase again, determined, whatever Hermione said, to devote an hour or two to the Room of Requirement. Once out of sight of the entrance hall, Harry pulled out the Marauder's map and his invisibility cloak from his bag. Having concealed himself, he tapped the map, murmured, "I solemnly swear that I'm up to no good," and scanned it carefully. As it was Sunday morning, nearly all the students were inside their various common rooms, the Gryffindors in one tower, the Ravenclaws in another, the Slytherins in the dungeons, and the Hufflepuffs in the basement near the kitchens. Here and there, a stray person meandered around the library or up a corridor. There were a few people out in the grounds, and there, alone in the seventh-floor corridor, was Gregory Goyle. There was no sign of the room of requirement, but Harry was not worried about that. If Goyle was standing guard outside it, the room was open, whether the map was aware of it or not. He therefore sprinted up the stairs, slowing down only when he reached the corner into the corridor, when he began to creep, very slowly, towards the very same little girl, clutching her heavy brass scales that Hermione had so kindly helped a fortnight before. He waited until he was right behind her, before bending very low and whispering, "Hello, you're very pretty, aren't you?" Goyle gave a high-pitched scream of terror, threw the scales up into the air and sprinted away, vanishing from sight long before the sound of the scales smashing had stopped echoing around the corridor. Laughing, Harry turned to contemplate the blank wall, behind which, he was sure, Draco Malfoy was now standing, frozen, aware that someone unwelcome was out there, but not daring to make an appearance. It gave Harry a most agreeable feeling of power as he tried to remember what form of words he had not yet tried. Yet this hopeful mood did not last long. Half an hour later, having tried many more variations of his request to see what Malfoy was up to, the wall was just as doorless as ever. Harry felt frustrated beyond belief. Malfoy might be just feet away from him, and there was still not the tiniest shred of evidence as to what he was doing in there. Losing his patience completely, Harry ran at the wall and kicked it. Ouch! He thought he might have broken his toe. As he clutched it and hopped on one foot, the invisibility cloak slipped off him.
"Harry?"
He spun round, one-legged, and toppled over. There, to his utter astonishment, was Tonks, walking towards him as though she frequently strolled up this corridor. "What are you doing here?" he said, scrambling to his feet again. Why did she always have to find him lying on the floor?
"I came to see Dumbledore," said Tonks.
Harry thought she looked terrible, thinner than usual, her mouse-coloured hair lank. "His office isn't here," said Harry. "It's round the other side of the castle, behind the gargoyle."
"I know," said Tonks. "He's not there. Apparently he's gone away again."
"Has he?" said Harry, putting his bruised foot gingerly back on the floor. "Hey, you don't know where he goes, I suppose?"
"No,"
said Tonks.
"What did you want to see him about?" "Nothing in particular," said Tonks, picking, apparently unconsciously, at the sleeve of her robe. "I just thought he might know what's going on. I've heard rumours, people getting hurt."
"Yeah, I know, it's all been in the papers," said Harry.
"That little kid trying to kill his—" "The prophet's often behind the times," said Tonks, who didn't seem to be listening to him. "You haven't had any letters from anyone in the Order recently?"
"No one from the Order writes to me any more," said Harry.
"Not since Sirius—"
He saw that her eyes had filled with tears.
"I'm sorry," he muttered awkwardly. "I mean, I miss him as well."
"What?" said Tonks blankly, as though she had not heard him.
"Well, I'll see you around, Harry."
And she turned abruptly and walked back down the corridor, leaving Harry to stare after her. After a minute or so, he pulled the invisibility cloak on again and resumed his efforts to get into the room of requirement, but his heart was not in it. Finally, a hollow feeling in his stomach and the knowledge that Ron and Hermione would soon be back for lunch made him abandon the attempt and leave the corridor to Malfoy, who, hopefully, would be too afraid to leave for some hours to come. He found Ron and Hermione in the great hall, already halfway through an early lunch.
"I did it! Well, kind of," Ron told Harry enthusiastically when he caught sight of him. "I was supposed to be apparating to outside Madame Puddyfoot's tea shop, and I overshot it a bit, ended up near Scrivenshaft, but at least I moved."
"Good one," said Harry. "How do you do, Hermione?"
"Oh, she was perfect, obviously," said Ron, before Hermione could answer. "Perfect deliberation, divination, and desperation, or whatever the hell it is. We all went for a quick drink in the Three Broomsticks after, and you should have heard Twycross going on about her. I'll be surprised if he doesn't pop the question soon."
"And what about you?" asked Hermione, ignoring Ron. "Have you been up at the Room of Requirement all this time?"
"Yep," said Harry. "And guess who I ran into up there? Tonks."
"Tonks?" repeated Ron and Hermione together, looking surprised.
"Yeah, she said she'd come to visit Dumbledore." "If you ask me," said Ron, once Harry had finished describing his conversation with Tonks, "she's cracking up a bit, losing her nerve after what happened at the Ministry."
"It's a bit odd," said Hermione, who for some reason looked very concerned. "She's supposed to be guarding the school. Why is she suddenly abandoning her post to come and see Dumbledore when he's not even here?"
"I had a thought," said Harry tentatively. He felt strange about voicing it. This was much more Hermione's territory than his. "You don't think she can have been, you know, in love with Sirius?" Hermione stared at him.
"What on earth makes you say that?"
"I don't know," said Harry, shrugging. "But she was nearly crying when I mentioned his name, and her Patronus is a big four-legged thing now. I wondered whether it hadn't become, you know, him."
"It's a thought," said Hermione slowly. "But I still don't know why she'd be bursting into the castle to see Dumbledore, if that's really why she was here."
"Goes back to what I said, doesn't it?" said Ron, who was now shovelling mashed potato into his mouth. "She's gone a bit funny. Lost her nerve."
"Women," he said wisely to Harry. "They're easily upset."
"And yet," said Hermione, coming out of her reverie, "I doubt you'd find a woman who sulked for half an hour because Madame Rosmerta didn't laugh at their joke about the hag, the healer, and the Mimbulus Mimbletonia."
Ron scowled.